And what you see when you look at cancers, whether they be lung cancer or colon cancer or breast cancer, is that a lot of the cells, sometimes even the majority of the cells in a tumor, are not actually cancer cells, but they're immune cells. And that really underscores the fact that cancer is a, you know, disease of the immune system. It's a disease really of immune dysregulation. And it makes sense because your immune system's in your body to protect you from, you know, foreign things like COVID and not attack normal things like your lung. And you were not born with cancer, and so it should be attacking the cancer, but cancer really, you know, hijacks your immune system and takes it over.
Welcome to the Oncology Insights Podcast, a weekly show where you'll find cutting-edge insights and everything that's working at the forefront of oncology.
Hello, everyone. My name is William Oh. I'm the host of the Oncology Insights Podcast. I'm very excited that we're launching this exciting series now today with my guest, Dr. Thomas Marin. By way of introduction, I'm the Director of Precision Medicine at the Yale Cancer Center and a medical oncologist, professor of medicine at Yale. So Tom, we have a lot to dig into. So can you please first introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I'm Tom Marin. I am an immunologist initially by training. I have a PhD in studying the innate immune system. And I'm also a thoracic medical oncologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And I also am the head of the phase one unit. We call it the early phase trials unit, which is a unit within the cancer center that runs a few dozen clinical trials looking at all sorts of different very novel therapies, lots of first-in-human therapies. My preference or research interest, is in cancer immunotherapies as an immunologist. And I'm also a professor of medicine and a professor of immunology and immunotherapy at Sinai.
That's a lot. That's why your whiteboard behind you has so many little letters about all the projects you're doing. And it's really exciting. And I know they're all linked. All your different interests and work have been linked by this common thread. So
WiseNetX turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetX.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
You've been studying the immune system and cancer for many years. So, you know, maybe just for the audience, because we hear a lot about immunotherapy, but I'm not sure that people really realize that this has been a controversial area and that the immune system was not always thought to be important for cancer. So can you just take us back a little, maybe to even the past, but then up to your training and what you were seeing in terms of the link between the immune system and cancer?
Yeah. So just, I mean, for starters, I always think it's important. I usually have this picture I show people of a lung cancer tumor that we have cut out of a patient and we've stained it with a variety of different antibodies. And what you see when you look at cancers, whether they be lung cancer or colon cancer or breast cancer, is that a lot of the cells, sometimes even the majority of the cells in a tumor, are not actually cancer cells, but they're immune cells. And that really underscores the fact that cancer is a, you know, disease of the immune system. It's a disease really of immune dysregulation. And it makes sense because your immune system's in your body to protect you from, you know, foreign things like COVID and not attack normal things like your lung. And you were not born with cancer. And so it should be attacking the cancer. But cancer really, you know, hijacks your immune system and takes it over. Looking at it that way, you say, obviously, this is, you know, an immune dysregulation, so we should be using immune therapies. But the reality is, you know, I was doing my PhD in immunology 15 years ago, and cancer immunology was not really a thing. And I told people I wanted to be a cancer immunologist, and a lot of people just laugh at me and say, you know, that's been a failed experiment for decades. And that's, you know, back then that was true and not true. You know, there were immune therapies, you know, the some of the first immune therapies actually were developed at Yale, where you work, using cytokines like interferon and interleukin-2. And these are things that activate your immune system to recognize and kill cancer. And they were effective, but not very effective. So, you know, when I was training, we had an ICU doctor from Yale actually come down to Sinai and tell us these stories of using IL-2. And what they would do is they would admit patients to the who had either renal cell carcinoma or melanoma to the ICU. I'm sure you know these stories back in the day. And you would kind of give people higher and higher doses of IL-2 because we knew we needed to get to very high doses to have the best impact. So you basically would go up until you almost killed a patient and then pull back a little bit. And only then would you potentially see a benefit, and it still really only benefited about 5% of patients. And so there were, you know, there was a lot of barriers to progress, but, you know, probably about 15 years ago, we started seeing some of the first, you know, phase three studies in New England Journal. And then ever since then, it's been, you know, year after year, many of studies showing that we can use immune therapy, specifically checkpoint blocking antibodies, to really rev up the immune system to recognize and attack cancer.
I do remember those days when I was an intern myself, 25, 30 years ago. And it was a non-specific immune kind of revving up, like pressing the gas pedal on the immune system, which we sometimes hear that analogy about what we're trying to do with immunotherapy. But the problem with treatments like interferon or IL-2 were they were too nonspecific. They were kind of inducing a flu-like syndrome, hoping that the right immune cell gets to the cancer cell, but just hoping and praying. And of course, the side effects of the treatment were so toxic, as you point out. So what was really... What was really the advance? Like, what was the change from that era? 5% response rates, maybe a couple of long-term responders. But what was the insight that led to treatments of what immunotherapy is now?
So there's many things called checkpoints that basically are stop signs, and they're stop signs that your immune system has used evolutionarily. It's a conserved sort of pairing of receptors and ligands that keep your immune system from getting too activated. And so we want our immune system to get activated, but not too activated, because if it's too activated, you get inflammatory and autoimmune diseases. So what happens is that cancer sort of hijacks, or it co-opts some of those normal evolutionarily conserved stop signs, if you will, and it you know, upregulates them and keeps the immune system at bay. And so checkpoint blocking antibodies, specifically blocking two different receptors and ligands. One is PD-1, PD-L1. So this is programmed death ligand 1. PD-1 is on T cells. PD-L1 is on either cancer cells or other immune cells that I call the professor cells of the immune system, the teacher T cells, what to attack. And then CTLA-4, it was really PD-1 and CTLA-4 targeting antibodies that sort of jump-started this whole field of cancer immunology. And it was initially done in the fields of melanoma and renal cell carcinoma, specifically melanoma, and then, you know, RCC was kind of second. But showing, you know, the ability for the immune system to, you know, recognize and kill this cancer that really was a cancer that, you know, in 2010 really was incurable if it was identified at the metastatic setting. And there was a very bad chemotherapy that we never really use anymore called dacarbazine, which was really the only option that we had for patients. And all of a sudden you give patients this, you know, immune therapy, and it revs up your immune system. And you were having patients that were on death's door that all of a sudden were being cured. And the one of the main reasons I actually went into oncology, I was planning on being a dermatologist because, you know, it seemed like a good life and it's super interesting immunologically.
Considered a good life, just to be.
It still is considered a good life. But I really enjoyed derm. I still work with our derm colleagues and they deal with a lot of interesting immune stuff. And cancer immunology, like I said, was one of those things that was a little poo-pooed. And I remember hearing about pseudoprogression in some of the early clinical trials of melanoma. And so this is the concept where if the medicine's working really well, you know, tumors actually get inflamed and bigger before they get smaller if your immune therapy is working. And there was a patient, I think it might have been at Sinai or one of the New York schools, that was on one of the early trials. And, you know, they went on the trial and then all of a sudden they had trouble breathing. They did an x-ray and they saw the tumors had doubled in size. So they sent the patient to a hospice up in the Bronx. And where they have a bar cart that serves martinis every night. And a patient went up there and he drank martinis for 3 months. And eventually the doctor said, "I don't think that you're dying." They did an x-ray and the patient was cured. And so I remember hearing about this pseudo-progression concept and just thinking it was the most, you know, mind-blowing idea that you might be able to really cure patients of incurable
disease.
That's
such a great story. And I think, yeah, it'd be great to find that person if he or she is still alive.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting you bring up the diseases in which it works, because actually one of the first trials of CTLA-4 antibody, one of the first checkpoints before PD-1, was in prostate cancer. And it was actually a negative study, and it's still negative. It still doesn't work. And this is, of course, the disease that I focused my career on. So So maybe you can just step back and say, you know, are we done? Like, is immunotherapy there? And we know it's not. Why does it work in some cancers, not work in others? And where do we have to kind of go next in thinking about next steps of immunotherapy?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we're always jealous of our melanoma colleagues because melanoma, you know, 50% of melanoma at this point is probably being cured with immune therapy. But the reality is that, you know, these therapies work best in tumors that are the most foreign looking. So melanoma obviously is very foreign, lots of DNA changes because of, you know, long-term skin damage. And you know, we have high rates of melanoma in places like Australia that don't have a lot of ozone. Lung cancer, smoking-related lung cancer specifically, that's my focus. Those patients do quite well also with immune therapy. But people think, oh, lung cancer, it's, you know, super responsive to immune therapy, unlike prostate cancer. But the majority of patients with lung cancer actually do not achieve a durable response. We're probably only curing maybe 15 to 20% of metastatic lung cancer. That's a lot better than 0%, which is what it was, you know, back when I started training. But, you know, we still have 80% of patients that are dying from their cancer. And then, as you mentioned, you know, prostate cancer really doesn't respond. And there's many cancers the more common types of breast cancer, hormone receptor positive breast cancer, colon cancer, that really don't respond to immune therapy. So we still have a lot of work to do. I'm not retiring anytime soon. And there's a few different reasons for that. So one is, you know, everyone's cancer is completely different and everyone's immune system is completely different based both on their genetics and also just what they've seen throughout their life. And all these different factors really dictate whether or not a patient is or isn't going to respond to immune therapy and whether or not that's going to be a durable response. And the reality is, you know, we have drugs that target, you know, two, actually now we have three of these stop signs, but it's really, you know, two that we're using commonly, CTLA-4 and PD-1. But not only are there dozens of stop signs, similar checkpoints that are, you know, proteins that are put up on the tumor surface that say, you know, don't attack me. But, you know, there's also dozens of other ways in which the cancer really co-opts the immune system and suppresses the immune system. And, you know, we're exploring all of those in our clinical trials right now and also in the laboratory, trying to identify what are the most important. The reality is that we're really going to need a personalized approach in the future because everyone, like I said, everyone's immune system is different, but everyone's cancer is kind of hijacking their body's immune system in a slightly different way. And until we really can understand that complexity and identify, you know, which way the cancer is hijacking the immune system, so what specific drug or combo that patient should receive, we're kind of still working in the dark. And that's really the focus of our work.
So, I mean, the immune system was developed so that we didn't die of overwhelming infections from the outside world. The true external element, the foreign element, is a bacteria or a virus or something that would otherwise kill us if our bodies didn't protect us. But cancer is really an aberration of ourselves, right? It's like a normal prostate cell or normal lung cell, and it gets damaged somehow and starts to grow uncontrollably. So in some ways, the cancer using checkpoints to protect itself is kind of like the same reason our bodies don't want to be attacked by our own immune system, which is kind of the opposite in autoimmune disease, right? Autoimmune disease, like diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, is the opposite problem. The immune system doesn't recognize that it's ourselves and attacks organs like our joints, for example. But in kind of parsing that line, threading that needle, I think, you know, that's why some of those patients, when we revved up the immune system so much, got so sick. I always tell people, when you get the flu, it's not the flu virus that's causing you to feel sick. It's your own immune system trying to get rid of the flu, maybe not always successfully. And so you sometimes need a booster like a flu vaccine. So where do vaccines fit in this story? Like, you know, we've been talking about cancer vaccines for a long, long time. Are we making progress? Is that the kind of personalization you're talking about?
Yes and no. So I think that there's personalization in the ability to, you know, look at a patient, draw blood, do a biopsy and say, okay, we're going to give you this cocktail of drugs that are off the shelf drugs. But we're also seeing more and more improvements in the vaccine space and cancer vaccine space. And we're calling it something different from vaccine for political reasons at this point, but it's personalized neoantigen therapies are what we're doing. And there's been some significant success recently. You know, we've done vaccines for the last 10 years where we actually are teaching a patient's immune system what to recognize an attack. Because your immune system is normally very tolerant of self-antigen. To your point, if your immune system was attacking, you know, normal cells, you get things like lupus and all the other inflammatory diseases. And so it takes a lot of revving up to get your immune system to recognize normal proteins in your body. And the cancer proteins, then what we call neoantigens, so these are mutated proteins, so they are foreign to your body, but they look kind of similar to your body. So it takes that much more oomph, that much more of a vaccine, you know, drive to get your immune system to recognize and attack this thing that's foreign, but not as foreign as, let's say, COVID, which obviously is very foreign. It doesn't look anything like your prostate or your lung. And so, but we're making these neoantigen vaccines where you basically can take a patient's tumor, you sequence the genetics of their tumor, you sequence their germline DNA, and you see what is unique in the tumor. You do a variety of additional analyses like RNA and protein analysis to make sure that the cancer is actually expressing these mutated proteins. And then you choose what to vaccinate them against. And you can do this by, you know, synthesizing the mutated protein. We call these peptide vaccines. Or you can develop nucleotide vaccines. So you can do either RNA or DNA vaccines, the same sort of RNA technology that helped us get the COVID vaccines. We can use that technology, and this was in development well before COVID, to basically sequence and basically trick your arm where you're doing the injection into making a vaccine, making these foreign proteins, then teaching your immune system, hey, this is what you want to be on the lookout for. Because a lot of patients, you know, both in prostate cancer, but about a third of our lung cancer patients, even if they're smokers and have lots of, you know, mutated proteins, they have no pre-existing immunity against their tumor, especially in older patients. Their immune system hasn't been taught, hey, this is what you should be on the lookout for, even though it's foreign. And so it's really about teaching your immune system what to recognize. You know, you use the metaphor, you know, taking your brakes off the gas or off the brake. Taking your foot off the brake in a car. That's what we're doing with checkpoint blockade. But if you take your foot off the brake in a car that's on a flat surface, the car's not going anywhere. And so you really need to shove your foot on the gas at the same time as you take your foot off the brake if you want to get the immune system to recognize and attack it. So that's what, you know, we're doing with vaccines, is we're teaching the immune system, hey, this is what to be on the lookout for. And you know, it then goes all throughout your body, not only hopefully just killing the cancer, but particularly in the post-operative setting, which is where we've had the greatest benefit. That's really where we think we're priming an immune response to identify micrometastatic disease so that the cancer doesn't come back after surgery.
That's really fascinating. And I'm sure, I know the technological challenges are improving because the ability to generate these personalized neoantigen vaccines is getting faster and easier, but picking the right sequence or the right specific approach for each patient is a challenge. So what about CAR Ts? I mean, can you, this is cellular therapy. Could you just describe what a CAR T is and how it's different from the approach you just mentioned and whether it's better, worse, or just different?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's one of those medical marvels that, you know, we heard about in the lab and we thought it was really interesting and never really would work in humans, but it is curing particularly, you know, kids and adults with leukemia and some lymphomas right now. But so CAR Ts, you know, your T cell is your killer cell within your immune system. And so your T cell has a very specific receptor and it goes throughout your body and it identifies a cell that might be infected with a virus or a cancer cell and it kills it. And those are the cells with our vaccine we're basically priming T cells to recognize and attack cancer. What CAR T cells are is basically we take a patient's blood, we isolate their T cells in the laboratory in a petri dish, we genetically modify them so that receptor, we instead of teaching that T cell what to recognize in the body, we're basically genetically modifying that T cell so it has a receptor that can, you know, hone in and kill cancer cells, and then you infuse it back into the patient. So the greatest success has been at targeting B-cell antigens like CD20, CD19, that these are very specific proteins that are on B-cell cancers, but they're also on normal B-cells. And so they're on every B-cell in your body, whether it be a cancerous B-cell or a normal B-cell. So you can give patients a CAR T-cell, goes in their body, and it kills every B-cell in their body. And that gets rid of the cancer. It also gets rid of your normal B cells. So these patients are inherently immune compromised, but it's something that we can make up for. We can give them IVIG and basically sort of make up for the loss of that part of their immune system. So it's not...
B cells normally make antibodies and they also protect us, but maybe not as important as T cells in this particular case. but when you wipe them out, then you become susceptible. So IVIG is basically intravenous antibody therapy, right?
Yeah, you can think of it as a expensively expendable part of your immune system. So we can make up for it. The problem is that if you have, let's say you have lung cancer, so your lung cancer has a protein, lung cancer protein A, let's say, and you make a CAR T cell against that, the problem is that is not just on the cancer, it's also on the rest of your lungs. So you could make that CAR T cell and you would kill the cancer cell. You'd also kill the patient because you get rid of the rest of their lung. So we're having a lot of trouble identifying things that are specific for the cancer and don't result in bystander killing. You don't want to kill the healthy tissue and the bad tissue at the same time. And so there's many barriers. There's that, and there's a few other barriers that are really limiting our ability to use this technology, which is amazing in hematologic cancers like leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma. We really haven't been able to translate that into humans. We're making significant progress, and I think that within the next 5 to 10 years, we are going to have solid tumor cell therapies. We have a whole network here in New York State where we're making our own CARs up at Roswell Park, and we're going to be putting those in patients soon, and hopefully we'll see some progress there. And we're learning a lot every time we do it and we fail. Thankfully, we're doing this at academic centers where there's a lot of research studying why is it that we're failing. So we're constantly learning from our own mistakes and making a next version, you know, version 2.0, 3.0, 4.0 are always going to be better. So I think we are making progress.
I realize we use a lot of automobile analogies, both with regard to revving up the immune system, putting the brakes on the immune system, and just in the term CAR T, which I've seen lots of variations on the idea. CAR T, of course, standing for these modified cells that attack cancer. So I want to shift gears a little bit to a Wall Street Journal article that you and the program at Mount Sinai were highlighted in. Really, a really fascinating subject. And you hinted at it a little bit earlier, which is really what happens as we get older. What's going on with our immune system when we get older? And how can we both understand it better, the biology, but also exploit it for targeting treatments, particularly in older people, but in all people?
Yeah, so we're studying this field called inflammaging, which is really the inflammation that comes with aging that is really, it's becoming evident in the last few years that it's at the heart of most disease that happens as you get older, whether it be cancer, cardiovascular disease, you know, most diseases, you know, age is the number one risk factor. And we really realize that it's probably underlying inflammation that is leading to all this. It's really immune dysregulation. So taking a step back, I always figured, and this is what we were taught in medical school, is that the reason you get cancer when you get older is really two different things. One is it's a lifetime of exposures to toxic chemicals and pollution and cigarette smoking and going to the beach. And so you basically accumulate mutations over time. And at the same time, as you have more and more mutations, your T cell function is slowly going down, you know, when you hit 50, 60, 70. And so it's sort of the constellation of those two factors, the intersection of those that leads to cancers. So you all of a sudden have a cancer and your T cells, you know, you might develop cancers, you know, while we're talking, maybe you and I develop cancers, but within 10 minutes, the T cells will kill them. And then 10 minutes later, we'll get a new cancer. The problem is when we get older. Terrifying thought.
It's a very terrifying thing.
As we get older, you know, our T cells aren't doing their job. So that's what I always figured was the case. But what we've realized, and we've had a few publications about this recently, looking at humans initially, our work is very, you know, reverse translational. So we always sort of try to make our observations in our human patients and then bring it back to mice. And what we realized is that both in mice and in humans, as you get older, there's a very specific change that's happening in your immune system. This is regardless of cancer, that your immune system really starts tilting in the wrong direction. And people think, oh, you don't have enough immune inflammation, but you actually have too much inflammation. And your body is really tilting towards a bad part of your immune system. So the immune system, there's good guys and bad guys in the immune system. It really is tilting towards the myeloid side of the immune system, and it's becoming too inflammatory. And anybody who took care of COVID patients or read the New York Times following COVID, you knew that old people were the ones that were dying of COVID. And the reason was, it wasn't necessarily the COVID, you know, to your point that you just made, it's your immune system's response to infection that makes you feel bad. And one thing we realized, we were doing, you know, Mount Sinai was sort of the epicenter of this, as you well remember. And we were doing autopsy studies on these patients and their lungs that were just flooded with inflammation and fluid, and there was no virus there. So the virus was already gone. What happens is that old people, they're too inflamed and they react too robustly. And it's the bad immune response that is what actually made people very sick. It was one of the reasons why we oftentimes would use, you know, immune modulators like steroids. You know, there was the hydroxychloroquine was one of the first things that we tried. Didn't really work that well, but we were using lots of other things like IL-6 blockade, all these cytokine blocking antibodies that were really trying to quell the inflammation that was killing people from COVID. And we realize that, you know, as you get older, you get more and more inflammation, and it basically turns your body into a petri dish. It makes it very easy for cancer to grow, this bad inflammation, because it's just one more way in which the cancer can kind of escape the immune system recognizing and killing it. And, you know, based on our preclinical stuff working in mice, and then we've translated this now into humans, we're using immune suppressants, sort of very targeted immune suppressants that hopefully will target the bad part of the immune system and not the good part, that will hopefully overcome this and allow your immune system to do its job and kill cancers.
This is one of the reasons I didn't go into immunology, because I would see those big posters in the lab with you know, all the connections between the immune system, and say, this is just way too complicated to understand. Because on one level, as we talked about earlier, if you get an infection and your immune system doesn't get inflamed, you will die. On the other hand, when your immune system's overinflamed, the so-called bad inflammation, it can lead to things that can kill you. It's a very, very complicated system. And in some ways, like, you know, when we went into medicine, it's like, it's amazing we're still alive, because it seems like there's so many things that can go wrong in the system. But in truth, it's an amazing system, right? It's why we can live, you know, 70, 80, 90 years with all of these assaults on us from the outside world. And yet we're still able to, for the most part, live healthy and live longer. But there is this interesting thing, and I wanted you to comment on it, which is we're seeing some earlier cancers, earlier onset cancers in colon cancer and breast cancer and people who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s in ways that we hadn't seen in the past. And I did read one paper that suggested that part of this was that we see immune effects or immune systems that are similar to older people in patients who are, I don't know, that may be too simplistic, because I'm not sure we know all the aspects of this kind of, you know, myeloid or kind of dysfunctional immune system. But do you have a theory on what's happening here with early onset cancers?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely multifactorial. So I think that there is more and more of this bad inflammation that I would say is associated with our diet in particular. And so we're not seeing this incidence of, you know, very high rates of juvenile or, you know, cancers in 20 and 30 year olds, which I'm seeing lots of referred to my phase one program. You're not seeing it in, you know, rural parts of Africa or South America or Asia. And so we think that it probably is in part due to lots of, you know, sort of chronic inflammation that's happening from a very early age, getting your kids' meals at McDonald's. And so I think that, you know, we are going to be seeing continually more and more of these. And it probably has something to do with that inflammation, that bad inflammation that we're characterizing in 60 and 70 year olds, really sneaking up earlier and earlier in the population due to this sort of toxic assault that is starting much earlier in life that, you know, my parents didn't have the processed foods that we have. I think that there's some interesting papers recently that have also suggested there's a role for the microbiome and certain microbes that are more common in certain populations. Potentially, you know, we see them a lot in the U.S. That one of the studies I'm thinking of, actually, they also had populations that had similar microbial exposure in Vietnam, which is not having the same, you know, toxic, you know, McDonald's exposure that we're having, or it probably now is, but they weren't back in the day. And we think that there probably is some sort of dysregulation in the microbes in the gut. And that, you know, that really, there's two problems there. One is that your intestines are your largest immune organ. So they're the ones that the intestine is really, and all the microbes in your intestine are really what gear and target, direct the way in which your immune system responds to things. And we know, you know, all those checkpoint blocking antibodies we talked about earlier, that, you know, depending on which microbes you have in your intestines will really tell us whether or not you're going to respond to checkpoint blockade. We have a paper that we just just submitted, you know, really identifying a few specific bugs that are really bad actors that we probably should be targeting therapeutically. So there's that part of the microbiome that is really screwing with your body's ability to recognize and kill cancer. But also there are certain microbes, and this was the paper I was referring to, where it was, you know, in the US and in Vietnam and in Russia, where they had certain microbes that were actually secreting chemicals that were leading to DNA damage. And so this was a paper that was looking at colon cancer specifically, and they were seeing this colonization with these microbes early on in life, even during your first and second year, was creating this DNA damage that was predisposing you to get cancer 20 or 30 years later. So by the time that we're looking at those cancer patients and they're 30, they don't even have that bacteria anymore. Oftentimes it's this very early damage, because cancer can grow, especially things like colon cancer. We know it grows over decades oftentimes. And it really, that makes it tough to study, because we don't know what we should be intervening on and when we should be doing our interception. But I think it's probably, you know, we are seeing more and more young people, and I think there's a mixture of exposures and also just, you know, the immune dysregulation that comes with those exposures.
Yeah, I think it kind of snuck up on us, on a lot of us. You know, when you go back a decade or two, we thought we were starting to beat cancer, and death rates were starting to go down, and incidence rates were starting to go down, and there's this just bizarre trend, and it just shows you how intimidating and how humbling it is to be a cancer doctor. And that's why we need to continue to do the research that you're doing in your group. It was a really great conversation. I'm going to ask you to end our podcast today. And first of all, thank you very much. It's just really great insights. I think it's exactly what we're trying to convey, is what do we know on the science and on the clinical care and the diagnosis. We're going to try to delve into more of these issues, but the immune system is really such an important piece of this. But I'm going to have you end, Tom, on what you're most excited about. Like, what treatments and what insights are going to help us to fight these cancers more effectively in the next 5 to 10 years? What do you think is going to make the biggest difference?
I really do think that it's going to be, you know, that I study the myeloid side. I was telling you there's too many myeloid cells in older people. And when you look at a tumor, the majority, you know, all of our therapies are focused on T cells, which only make up 10% of the immune cells. But more than 50%, sometimes more than 80% of the immune cells are myeloid cells, macrophages and neutrophils. And we have zero therapies that target those. And so I think that we're going to see, I think that's the next frontier. We're already seeing lots of companies investing in creating these new therapies that are really targeting that side of the immune system, because we're going to need these combinatorial approaches. We've gone as far as we can with PD-1 blocking antibodies, and we need, you know, a combination that overcomes that bad inflammation that happens. And I think that that's super exciting for me as far as, you know, helping our patients with metastatic cancer. But I think the most exciting thing that I'm doing right now, and which I do in part just to make sure that keep up the morale in the group, is immunoprevention, and really, you know, identifying this bad inflammation that we're seeing that happens with age, and identifying interventions that can reverse that. Because it's, I ideally would be out of a job at some point soon, and we won't have patients with cancer anymore. But the only way to do that is we're never really going to be able to treat everyone with metastatic cancer. A lot of the times the horse is already out of the barn at that point, and it's too late. We really should be preventing cancer before it starts. And I think that, you know, tackling this intervention, both through, you know, lifestyle interventions, but also just immune modulators, is really what we're going to see change the trajectory that we're seeing within the next 10 to 20 years.
Well, sign me up, Tom. Let me know what I should be taking and doing, besides the obvious, of course. But I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Thomas Maron, professor of medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and the leader of the early phase clinical trials program at the Tisch Cancer Institute. Really, thank you again for your time, Tom. My name is William O. I'm Director of Precision Medicine at the Yale Cancer Center, and thank you for joining the Oncology Insights podcast.
Thanks, William.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.